I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Graham Cox. Welcome, Graham.
Thank you.
Graham, you know Frio like the back of your hand. When did you first start coming to Frio?
Well, probably a few months after I was born, I guess. Because I was born in South Perth and grew up in Alfred Cove in Latham Street.
And so, for people from this side of the river, Fremantle was always town. It was a place
you
came.
It was the big smoke. Everything we did, we came to Fremantle to do. It was too far to go to Perth, and you had to go through the bush, Applecross. So at least it was urbanised between Alfred Cove and Fremantle in those days.
Once upon a time, the trams went from Central Frio near where we are in the West End, right down to Point Walter.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it?
Probably come back in a few years.
Yeah, why not? Bring the trams back.
And the other thing that might come back, Graham, are small ocean-going ships, do you reckon?
I was just talking before about the Batavia in terms of Dyfken being lost to Fremantle, that the Batavia is in danger of being turned into a dive wreck in the Netherlands. There's no money at Lelystad to pay for it anymore. And the guy who built the ship, Willem Vos, has actually said it. He said he wouldn't mind it to be turned into a duck habitat on the IJsselmeer. But 1629, 2029, it's the 400th anniversary. The Batavia story is our story, really, isn't it? I suggested that we should buy the ship. I reckon they'd pay us to take it away. Bring it out here, bring it to Fremantle or Geraldton. Fremantle and Geraldton can fight over it. I don't care where it goes. Build a building like the Vasa Museum in Stockholm. And the great thing about that is the Vasa Museum, you can't walk on the ship, as you know, Mike.
I've visited it, yes.
You can only look at the ship. The Batavia replica could be put inside a building on the hard standing, completely decked out like it was moments before it hit the reef at the Abrolhos, and in a climate-controlled environment inside a big building. Could you imagine a better thing to put in for the 400th anniversary?
Well, we've got a lot to thank the Dutch for. Most of their ships got through to Batavia. Safe and sound, as they made fortunes for the Dutch East India Company. But a couple of them hit our coast, Batavia being one of them. But there's another one that actually didn't crash and burn or whatever, found on rocks, and we're talking about the little Dyfken.
Yes, the Dyfken, the little dove.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tell us how, a lot of people will know the story, but tell us how she came to meet Australia.
Well, it was 400 years ago. The Portuguese dominated the spice trade in Europe, and they'd come out and they'd taken over a lot of the trading ports in Indonesia right through to Sri Lanka, Malacca. And the Dutch came out with faster ships like the Dyfken, superb little, fast, highly armed, aggressive little, nasty little ships, really, very aggressive ships. And they decided to take over the spice trade. So they went through, and by 1606, they had pretty much established their domination over the spice trade, and the Dyfken was one of those little ships that did during battles with the Portuguese. And then there was a mythical land of gold, which goes back even, Magellan looked for the land of gold. He wasn't looking for spices, he was looking for gold when he sailed around the world. The Dyfken crew, William Jansz, he was sent out to learn to look for the mythical land of gold at Os Papuas, about where Vanuatu is today. They thought, let's just go that way and have a look for it, with the winds blowing that way in summer, in our summer. So they set off from Banda, sailed on the winds to hit land, or came across a place which is now Cape York, the Pennefather River.
So they're out looking for it, and around about the same time, you've got De Quiros and Torres coming from the other side.
Yeah, Torres came through, I think, is it 9 months later? There's always a great debate about Torres and whether he discovered Australia or not. And he sailed through the gap between Papua New Guinea and Australia, and today there is a little dot 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 on the map that says that's New Guinea, this, you know, Papua New Guinea, this is Australia. But he never did enough to really say that he came to Australia. Whereas William Yeats and Dyveken, it's the first time recorded in history that Aboriginal people met people from the outside world. And the first time Australia appeared on a chart. So it gets the gong for that.
Well, you've written and just launched over the last weekend a weighty tome, it might be described as, Graham, Through Darkest Seas, the untold story of how Dyveken, Australia's first ship, was recreated and sailed into history, dot, 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 again.
Again, yes.
It's amazing. Tell us how you got into to be involved with this tiny little ocean-going vessel.
Wow, it goes back to Christmas 1993. A guy who lived in Fortescue Street in East Fremantle, Michael Young, who was a Dutch migrant, son of Cloggies, he wrote a letter to the Fremantle Herald because ever since he arrived in Australia, it had annoyed the hell out of him that Captain Cook is always said to have discovered Australia. Well, he wasn't even a captain, he was lieutenant at that time, of course, but he really only mapped the last quarter of the Australian continent, the eastern line of it. The Dutch, for 164 years, had been visiting Australia, and yet he was a Dutch kid with all of these history books about Australia, and none of them giving a mention to William Yeats. So he always had it in his head. And Endeavour was due to go to leave Fremantle forever, basically to be relocated in Sydney, National Maritime Museum, under a deal with the federal government and brokered, I think, by John Dawkins, and he had a lot to make it happen right at the end, I think. But Michael Young wrote a letter to Andrew Smith at the Fremantle Herald and said, Endeavour's leaving Fremantle. We should build another ship and it should be the Dyveken. And that letter got in the last week of 1993 in the Fremantle Herald. And in the next couple of weeks, he received, I think it's about 40, probably 40 letters odd to say, well, we think this is a great idea, we should do it. The West Australian, Me Too, they published the letter because he had sent it to a few people. They published it a few weeks later and it took off outside of the confines of Fremantle. I was on Endeavour early one morning. We had a twilight or a sunrise sail out in Gage Roads. And I was out there with John Longley, and I'd done a lot of work for Endeavour in the lead up to the launch, and later I did some work with them in South Africa. But I said to John, who is this guy, Michael Young? What's he about? And John thought, I don't need another replica ship project. And he said, you've got some marketing savvy. You should offer your services to him because they need somebody with marketing skill. So he gave me Michael's number. And so I rang Michael up. He said, yeah, we've got a meeting on the weekend. So I turned up at Michael's house and there was nobody home. So I sat on the step. And then Michael Young turned up. He was sort of dressed in a cheesecloth shirt, very Fremantle, and apologised for being late. And a group, I think there's about 8 or 10 of us there, had a meeting, ate cinnamon biscuits, drank coffee. Michael did, handed out lots of photocopies of all sorts of stuff to us like a school teacher. And that was, we agreed to work on it. Let's make it happen.
Let's go back just a couple of jots. The Endeavour. And the fascination that many of us have with old ships, whether shipwrecked or rotting at the bottom of the sea, or and then making replicas of them. The Endeavour's all explicable because Australia was doing a couple hundred years after Cook, sort of thing, wasn't it? But what about the broader fascination? I mean, after Endeavour, did it seem like that was the end of it? We've done that, it was an interesting exercise.
Well, one of the things we did in our persuasive arguments to get money was that the skills of building Endeavour in Fremantle would be lost if another ship wasn't built, and we could create a shipbuilding, replica shipbuilding industry in Fremantle. That was actually an interesting idea at the time, but it's never been proven to be true, because the ports that want to build ships want to build them in the port that they're at to get the benefits of building the ship in the port. And so we use that as an argument, which was the government was pretty supportive of. Richard Court was the premier at the time. He was pretty supportive of the idea. But there's a romance with the ships, and I think history, modern history of these ships proves that everybody wants to give you money to build a ship. If you came up with an idea tomorrow to build the Mermaid, you know, or something, you know, Bass's ship or something like that, or one of the little Dutch ships, you'd get the money, because people will give you money to build ships because they can see that it's going into the object. The big thing is running them afterwards. That's the hard bit.
And we'll get back to this point later, but where's the Dyfken now?
Well, the federal government has the ship at the Australian National Maritime Museum in Sydney, and that was done under a deal with the Dyfken 1606 Replica Foundation. Look, when I was running the Dyfken, we went broke four times. Under my stewardship, I was trying to count it a few days ago. I think we went broke four times while I was running the ship. It wasn't going to go on forever as an independent foundation. And in the end, a deal was brokered with the assistance of John Longley again, I must say, and Senator Ian Campbell from Perth, ex-senator. They got the National Maritime Museum to take the ship over. And it wasn't the first time, actually, we'd offered the ship to the National Maritime Museum, but those two guys being on the board certainly helped this time round.
Raise the visibility.
Yeah.
So the Michael Young Connect, of course, explains a lot. Mm. Dutch people, great boat builders, Second World War, lots of them landed here after the war, lots came here. Indonesia became a republic and the Dutch were sent packing in that sense. But the Dyfken never made it to Fremantle or Wallalup or anywhere down this part of the world.
Well, we'd never be able to afford to build the Batavia. It's a cursed ship anyway, as we always say. The ships that explored the Australian coastline in the 164 years after Dyfken, before Cookie came up the east coast, in that time there was, I think it was 26 voyages of discovery to Australia at that time. But they were Dutch East Indiamen, they were big ships. Dyfken was the first ship in Australia's history, and it was small, so it was relatively cheap to build. And so it had a lot going for it. But we've always had with the project, and it's happened since absolutely day one, when people said, don't build it, it's not a West Australian ship. And even with the singing minister recently who didn't stop the ship going to Sydney, the same argument was put, it happened in Cape York Peninsula, it's not part of our history. Well, actually in 1606 there weren't any state borders, Minister, and that is a nonsense argument. But that argument still holds sway. There's a parochialism about these things that sometimes you can't get beyond with states and governments thinking.
I'm sure there's a song line between the west side of Cape York and Fremantle. But tell our listeners the dimensions of the Dyfken.
Well, she's under 20 metres long from stem to stern. She's about that tall from the top of the mainmast. The sleeping accommodation in the ship down below is you could fit two cars in that area. I always say it's a double car garage down below, but it slept on the concrete floor. She's a tiny ship. She's only really two complete decks with a mezzanine, if you like, in between, small deck. She weighs 100 tonnes, more or less. and she's got walls of oak.
There's a super yacht in Rouse Head Harbour at the moment, Graham, which is about 45 metres long, the Immortalis. You can buy her for $6 million Australian dollars. But this is half the size of that. How did it ever get through the high seas to Batavia, let alone come across to Cape York?
The Dutch had an incredible record of survivability of their ships. I think in basically 180 years, 200 years, they only lost, out of, I think it was 2,000 voyages, they lost less than 1% of the ships. These ships are incredibly tough. They're beautifully built, and they're seagoing ships, and they had very good crews. And they used to sail between the Netherlands and Indonesia on a route that they understood intimately. I mean, they occasionally went off the route a bit and they banged into our coast, but not many of them did when you look at the number of voyages they had.
Well, it was the wind's fault, not their fault, I expect.
Well, it's that latitude and longitude problem.
That latitude and longitude problem. And in terms of latitude and longitude, how many people, humans, could actually comfortably, or probably uncomfortably, fit on this boat?
Well, they had a crew of 18. The hold would have been filled with stores and trading goods. And so most of the crew, except the captain and the supercargo, who was the merchant, I always called myself the supercargo because I wasn't a sailor. they would have a single cabin, the chart room, where the safe box was kept and everything else. Everybody else would basically sleep between the cannons, under skins, you know, animal skins stretched out, because nobody was allowed to sleep in the hold, because that was where all the food was and all the valuable goods. So people tended to sleep on deck mostly.
And coming then to the replica, You guys all get together with Michael Young in Fortescue Street. You finish off the cinnamon cookies, you have your second cup of Dutch coffee, and then someone says, well, how are we going to make this? What are we going to make it with? Yeah. Do we have the real plans? And forget about the money, we'll get the money, but how are we actually going to make this blessed thing?
Well, there was the money required to make it, and that was the first major problem. We knew approximately how long the ship was. We needed somebody to be the figurehead of the foundation, of a foundation to raise the money. And Michael George Kalis, MG, he was approached via his cousin, through a circuitous route. Michael and James Henderson, who's Graham Henderson's father, who you've had on Shipping News before, they got to see Michael Kalis, and Michael was the shipping magnate of Western Australia in those days. His fleet was the biggest, a Greek boy, but loved history. He was in the ideal target market for wealthy businessmen supporting projects like this, because he was at the age where he didn't have to work his business that hard and he could think about other things, about helping the community, which he always did. And incredibly, a Greek fisherman agreed to head the foundation to build a Dutch ship in an Australian town.
It's a great story in those early chapters of the book where MG makes it clear he'll do what you ask, but he'll be running it.
Yeah, there was no doubt that Michael was in charge, Michael Kalis was in charge, and he didn't want, he had built hundreds of vessels himself, a very successful shipbuilding business, and he knew intimately how to build a ship. He didn't know how to build a wooden ship like this, but he knew that you start, you get the materials you require, and you never stop, because as soon as you stop, that's when the bills start coming in. So he said, I want to build the ship in this number of years. This is what we're going to do. Failure will not be accepted.
We posted a lovely piece about Michael on the Young on the Shipping News not so long ago, and some lovely photographs of the Dofkin in its sort of final stages of, of construction. Mm. And for people who love their woodwork, or they don't have to be boat builders, but to, just to look at even the images, it was a magnificent thing to behold.
She was built from European oak, Quercus roba is the species, and even 400 years ago, the shipbuilders had decimated the forests of Europe. And so they had to go to the Baltic to get timber. And the timber, as it turns out, incredibly, the wreck of the Batavia, the remains of the Batavia in the shipwreck museum here, and the Dyfken, they've done genetic testing, and the timber that we bought from Latvia is sort of cousin timber of the timber that's on the Batavia. They went to that part of the world to get timber.
And well, I guess that's the benefits if you're running a big empire.
Well, yeah. There's a great story. We launched the book on Sunday night at the East Fremantle Tennis Club, and Josh McClernan was the youngest apprentice, and he came, which was just fantastic.
Lovely.
To see Josh and his wife Tracy. And I did my usual book launch sort of happy days, and he said, I've just remembered something. Okay, Josh, at the back though, I just remembered something I want to tell everybody. He said, when the oak timber arrived from Latvia, he said, we got the first shipment off, and we discovered right in the bottom of the shipping container, because it was a top-loading shipping container, he said, right at the bottom of the shipping container, there was a little package in there, and it was Latvian vodka. And he said that the timber cutters had given a little gift to the shipwrights.
It's probably a very ancient ritual in shipbuilding.
I said, Josh, you didn't tell me. I should have put it in the book. What a great story.
He probably drank it very quickly and felt guilty.
Well, what he said was that when every subsequent shipment arrived, there was no lack of people willing to help get all the timber out. And sure enough, other bottles arrived.
Well, it's probably like trying to discover Paul Rigby's little dog somewhere in the cartoon.
Yeah.
Now, Graham, you came on, in a sense, innocuously from the Endeavour project to the Dyfken project, but you filled all sorts of roles along the way. Just tell the listeners how intimately acquainted you were with this.
Well, I was the first president of the Friends of the Dyfken, which was the group that we formed from the committee, I guess. You know, Michael was of Dutch descent, and the Dutch invented the committee, and though they have committees, the Dutch. So I was involved with the Friends of the Dyfken, but pretty soon after Michael Kalis came on board, I was asked to have a meeting with him, and I met up at his office, and he said, look, I need somebody to do all of the marketing and to bring it all together that I can just ask to do things. So I'm going to put a chunk of money into the foundation, and it's going to be spent on you doing these things, Graham. You're happy to do that? I said, yeah, I'm in. Yeah, I'll help. So I was sort of Michael Kalis's hired gun, I guess, to do all of the things. The genius of Michael Kalis was that he knew that he couldn't necessarily do it himself, but he knew two people who had the savvy to do it and to raise the money. And that was Sir James Carruthers, who was Rupert's right-hand man, Rupert Murdoch's right-hand man, and ran, who was the Channel 7, and started Channel 7, you know, and had fantastic connections. Who, at the time, it was said that he was the fundraiser behind Fiona Stanley's success with her Children's Health Institute.
Yes.
And then Sid Corsa, and of course Sid just lives...
Famous Sid Corsa. Olympic yachtsman.
Yes, and Sid, who I said, I'm just a roof tiler, but he was much more than that. And Sid, I heard another story this week, Doug Carr from Shacks, he said, oh, Graham, because he came to the launch, and he said, there's a story you probably don't know. He said Sid was a super salesman. He sent Doug a letter and said, we need a ute for the Dyfken, and it doesn't matter what colour it is, and please find enclosed an order from Pacesetter Homes for three brand new utes.
Well, that's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah. So you stay with the project, but at a personal level, what did you know apart from what you were learning in Endeavour about yachts and boats and ships and the sort of stuff we're dealing with here before you became involved?
Well, I didn't know much about yachts. I'd sailed. I'm a hopeless sailor. I get seasick. I'm useless. I'm not good on the ship. I'd done twilights and Wednesday sailing on the river. I'm not a sailor. I'm a rower. Fremantle Rowing Club is my rowing club. I rowed there for many years, so I know the water and wood. But what I could bring to it was just a professional approach to setting up an organisation or sort of fundraising effort. So Sid Corsa and Sir James brought in Kerry Stokes and a guy, Gary Pearce, insurance guy. I remember Gary Pearce from Perth many years ago. So the genius of Sid Corsa, he said to his mates, he said, and a couple of other guys turned up on occasions, "I want 10 hours of your time. I don't want any money. I don't want you to give Divecon any money, but I want 10 hours of your time and we'll get a business plan together." And so about 30 hours later, these guys were coming down and meeting, and I was the scribe. So I used to have to do all of the work. I used to take down what they wanted done and then had to go and do it. So it was an incredible time for seeing these guys in there at the peak of their game. They were very good.
That would have been interesting. But then there's this point, as with every great business plan, where you then have to make it happen.
Yeah.
What were the highs and the lows of getting the thing made, constructed?
Well, the first thing was getting the timber from Latvia. That was difficult. That was the end of the Soviet Union and each of the independent countries, which Russia's trying to take back now. But Latvia was independent. It was trying to find its way. It wanted to help, but it was difficult. We needed somewhere to build the ship. We didn't have anywhere. Joe Rotondello offered us the Endeavour shed for $100,000 a year. And like hell was Michael Kalis going to pay $100,000 a year for the shed. The Port Authority would give us the slips down at Slip Street, but that was an awful place to do anything.
It would have been a lovely place, but an awful place.
Yeah. We had a close connection through James Henderson to Graham Henderson at the Maritime Museum. And there's a vacant block of land outside the museum. And against a lot of pushback from Fremantle residents, they gave us that chunk of dirt for as long as we needed it to put a shed up to build the ship. And that began a very close liaison with the Maritime Museum in terms of the design of the ship and the research muscle they had in the Netherlands. And that ensured that the ship that was built was the most exacting replica or reconstruction. The word replica is a nonsense with the Divecon in a sense, because we don't have the original plans for the ship. Like Endeavour was surveyed, so you know exactly what it looked like, but Divecon, the ships were never surveyed.
What was the hardest part about building it? Was it getting the labour?
No, people flocked to help build the ship. Volunteers, of it, mostly professional shipwrights built the ship, but there were lots of volunteers as well. The most difficult thing was that everybody wanted to build the most authentic ship that was possible. Endeavour had been built with Australian hardwoods, which were great for the longevity of the ship. They were bent using steam. There was a commitment to build Divecon by not only using the original materials, but using the original methods as well. And that meant fire bending the planks. So there's cellulose within timber. When you heat the timber up to just before it combusts, the cellulose becomes pliable and you can bend the timber. Like Aborigines bend their spears to make them straight, it's the same technology. And that the most difficult thing was bending the planks. I think it took weeks for the first plank to come to be bent, and then Bill Leonard, the master shipwright, said it's going to take us 10 years to build this ship at this rate. But they sped up, and in the end, they managed to master the art of firebending planks.
There must have been a moment, and I mean a moment, when the last thing was done in completing it.
Yes, well, the ship was launched. We took her down Market Street in Fremantle on the back of a semi-trailer, and she was launched at Boatlifters. Michael Kalis, of course, owned Boatlifters. And we launched the ship there. Then we had to finish the ship off. So she got pulled up near Zanzibar, Lombardo's, where it is still, that building. And we finished rigging the ship. The riggers worked down at B-Shed, Igor Bjorkston and Andrea Chikolis and a couple of others. They rigged made the rigging down there. And then we stepped the masts. And stepping the masts is a traditional process where you put a coin on the base of the mast, on the step, and then you fill it with tar, and the coin marks the age or the time when the ship, so you use a current coin, so you know when the mast gets pulled out, when the mast went in, because there's a coin with the date on it. So that the process of rigging the ship and stepping the mast is very quickly after that, it's a few weeks till the ship's completed and can sail. And Michael Kalis had been very sick, and he came down and he just couldn't really put the coin in, but his secretary, his PA, did it. And Julius Tahir flew down from Indonesia and did at the same time and did that. But unfortunately, Michael passed away shortly after that. And 2 weeks before we were due to sail the ship for the first time, so it was an incredible time.
It's really touching. At least he got to see the coin go in. Tell us about the journeys that the ship took, the first one you started to mention.
Well, the first voyage was from Fremantle to Indonesia and down to the Pennefather River to reenact the original voyage of discovery.
Down at Cape York, at Cape York, across at Cape York.
Across at Cape York. It had a few problems because we couldn't sail in summer, where it was easy to sail because of the cyclone season. We couldn't get insurance. So we had to sail during the time when the southeast trades pump up. So we sailed from Fremantle up to Banda in Indonesia. Magnificent voyage, and then the crew really did it tough sailing from Banda down to the Pennefather River. Made doubly difficult because the civil war in Indonesia was going on in Maluku, and there were places where we couldn't go. We couldn't go to Jakarta, couldn't go to Ambon. There's a whole list of places that we intended to go to that we couldn't, Ternate, because the Christians and the Muslim factions were fighting up there. But it was an incredible accomplishment, and the crew did it tough. They came down to the Pennefather River, and we had a very clear thought that if the traditional owners of the Pennefather River didn't want us there, then we wouldn't stop. So I had to ring Noel Pearson, who's from that area. And I rang up Noel and said, "Oh, we're intending to go to the Pennefather River," and he said, "You want us to dress up in traditional gear, do you? And you'll dress up like a bunch of clowns, and we'll have a little ceremony there, will we?" And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, we're not. If you don't want us to come, we won't come." And we're modern people, and we're going to dress in a modern way. And I don't care what you guys dress like. Anyway, I think Noel was taken aback by that, and he sort of went quiet. And he said, "Okay, then, I'll sort it out." And it was sorted, and the traditional owners are there, Than Kupi and her her friends, who are the women are the owners of the land, they're the custodians of the land.
Yes.
And so they're important to it. But they said only one thing, and I always think about this. They said, we only want one thing, Graham, we want you to have a white flag. Okay, a white flag. And I said, you have to bring the white flag. So I said to the captain, ship's master, Peter Manthorpe, make a white flag, put it on a pole, and that's what you're to bring in when you land. So a couple of the crew members paddled him in on the Orambai, which is a Dutch canoe which we'd got made in Indonesia because we couldn't afford to get one made here. And he came and he asked for permission to land. Now that was I told the crew that they could do whatever they liked. And we'd just been in Indonesia seeing the civil war and the VOC, the terrible atrocities committed by the VOC in Moluccas.
The Dutch East India.
And so I said to him, I'm not going to tell you, any of you, what to do. You talk about it, you do what you think as people is the right thing to do. So Mick Hemsley, who still lives down in Fremantle, Mick Hemsley is a ship's engineer, he said, well, we should ask for permission to land, shouldn't we?
Quite right.
Yeah. Well, that's the most fundamental thing in human history that invaders don't do they? They never ask for permission. So everybody sort of apparently at the meeting on board nodded their head and said, oh, that's a good idea, Mick. So Peter came ashore. He had the white flag. He put it in the ground. And John Cockatoo, who's one of the elders, came out with his spear and put the spear in the sand next to it. And we landed. It was our fundamental, looking back at it now, it's a powerful fundamental point of view of Australia.
And it's not that many years later, really, when you add them up.
No. Yeah. Well, the Dyfken is in the oral history of the people of Cape York.
Yes.
They remembered the ghost-like figures on this big canoe. White figures were seen as ghosts. The story's been told for 400 years. As a matter of fact, the Aboriginal people of Cape York own the Dyfken story. We don't own it. We forgot it.
Yeah.
They've never forgotten it.
In that first voyage, just looking at seamanship, did the captain and the sailors struggle?
Yes, yeah, and they ran out of food. We had to, and diesel, because of this ridiculous idea that we had to sail in the worst time of the year, to sail southeast. They had the engines on a lot, and the engines we had were just little Hino engines used as freezer motors for the trawlers, for the Kalis trawlers. But they're brand new, but they were little engines. We could only punch into the breeze for 350 nautical miles, so they actually had to stop at Amamapare in West Papua, of the port of the notorious Freeport mine, which we were actually prohibited from visiting, but we ran out of fuel and food just pumping into this weather. So the crew were incredible, tough bunch. Some of them still have the scars on their legs from the pustulous sores they got from the poor nutrition on that part of the trip. And I reckon if we'd never do it again, because we'd never get the occupational health and safety people to agree with it. But
probably as well you had the white flag when you're heading into some of those places.
Yes.
We'll jump forward in a sense. I mean, that's the end of the first journey, I think, back here. But then there's another big second journey. Tell us about that.
So basically, it was a damn good idea to have an expedition, but we ran out of money about the time we got coming down from Papua New Guinea into the east coast of Queensland. And the idea was to actually just sail around, bring the ship back to Fremantle, but we had no money to get back. But the 400th anniversary of the Dutch East India Company was coming up in the Netherlands. And I thought, well, here's a plan. We'll take the ship to the Netherlands and then bring it back to Fremantle, and we can sail to Fremantle on the way, and that'll all work out. We'll get some money from somebody else, from the Dutch government. So we were saved in sailing along the coast of Queensland by the huge reception we got, having the ship open for the public. And we made it down to Sydney with a charitable grant from a foundation, gave us $50,000 on as long as we arrived in Sydney, we'd get the money. So it was fabulous that we got there, but then we were completely broke. We'd gone without being paid for 3 months in that, and we were all pretty destitute.
Well, ready to mutiny. Where did you tie up in Sydney?
Well, we tied up at the Australian National Maritime Museum, who offered us a deal to be there, so we got some money coming in. And that was our first visit to the National Maritime Museum, and many more afterwards, and now she's permanently there. But the deal was done to go to the Netherlands, and the Dutch wanted us to put the ship on the back of a container ship and take her over there. We said to the Dutch government that we don't ship Dyfken, we'd sail her, and we're going to sail to the Netherlands. And we planned the voyage. It was a 12-month voyage from Sydney. By this stage, we could go to Jakarta, and Julius Tahir, who was one of our great supporters and sponsors, had got Habibie to agree for us to go to, President Habibie to agree for us to go there. And I think by then, by the time we got there, it was the woman running, the president, I can't remember her name, just temporarily forgotten her name. Anyway, we sailed from Sydney up through Torres Strait, across to Jakarta, through Anak Krakatoa, across to Galle in Sri Lanka, the most important trading port of the VOC in those days in the Indian Ocean, and then down to Rodrigues Island. Rodrigues was the first ship recorded in history to visit Rodrigues Island, which is near Mauritius, was Dyfken. So you can blame Dyfken for the gradual destruction of the enormous turtles and local dodo birds. But they were celebrating the 400th anniversary of that. So we went to there, down to Mauritius, Cape Town, and then up through the Atlantic to the little island of Texel near Amsterdam, which is where the original roadstead was for all of the ships. So we arrived there. Prince Willem Alexander, who had laid the keel in Fremantle back in 1995, he actually welcomed the ship when we arrived at Texel.
That's a beautiful story. And you managed to do it without being challenged by pirates off the African coast.
That's right. Well, we had a few hairy moments. I wasn't on the ship, of course, a hopeless sailor. But they got caught in the Agulhas Current on the Agulhas Bank. That was a hectic time. But we avoided the pirates. And that was by going around the Cape of Good Hope on the Brow route rather than going through Suez, which is the worst. In those days, it was the worst for yachts because you couldn't get away from the pirates.
They'd come out in their fast boats and deal with you.
Your history.
They'd be bigger than you.
Yes. And I never got the cannon working. I had a philosophy that we should be the little dove. We should be the ship of peace, not stress the negativity of it.
You've mentioned the prince. There must have been some welcome. How did the Dutch take to this?
Well, they irked us a little bit when we arrived. There was 20,000 people at the port. It's a little port, like I could imagine that the port of Texel's like Fremantle Fishing Boat Harbour. No, more like the Royal Perth Yacht Club Annex, actually. It's a tiny little port. 20,000 people there to welcome the ship, the king, his yacht. He brought his yacht over and parked it, which is a big barge with sails, and parked it next door. They irked us because they said, "Oh, our ship's back." No. It's an Australian ship. It's from Fremantle. You didn't build it. We built it. So we always got that while we're in the Netherlands.
They wanted to repossess it.
No, they've always wanted to buy it. And we always use that as the argument of why she shouldn't leave Fremantle, because the first people to make an offer will be Enkhuizen in the Netherlands, because they wanted a ship for their harbour.
Graham, your book through 29, 30 chapters, including an epilogue and a Life and Times album at the end, mentions all the important stages in the conception of the Dyfken, the replica, the reconstruction. Everybody who had some significant part to play in it is rightly acknowledged and should buy this book so their grandchildren can read it.
That's good, yeah, I like that.
And it tells you also about the ups and downs, and you've alluded to this earlier. It's this great, in a sense, 40, 30 odd years ago, people into doing this sort of old ship reconstruction. But then, as you've said, maintaining them can become the challenge.
Mm.
You went broke four times.
Yeah.
People's imaginations are full, but your coffers are not.
Yeah.
Well, so what are the lessons to be learned? Is there a future for this?
The lesson to be learned is that it requires $3,000 a day to keep running, and that if you can't find $3,000 a day, then don't own a replica ship. I remember we were at Lalystad, tied up next to the Batavia replica, and there was the most beautiful barge next to us. And I said, "How old's that barge? It looked brand new." And the guy who owned it looked at me and said, "Oh, it's 100 years old. Every single plank of that barge had been replaced recently with European oak." So it was a timber barge, 100 years old, with brand new everything. And that's the difficulty with the ship. The ports need to embrace the ship. It needs to become part of the port, as Lewin has done so successfully. You know, Malcolm Hayes' original idea of doing Lewin has absolutely brilliant. That ship has passed the test of time. Interesting thing, in those days, Malcolm's original idea was to build the Lewin, sail it until the maintenance costs got high, it was 5 or 6 years, then sell it and buy another Lewin, build another Lewin, and continue building new low maintenance ships. Of course, Lewin's steel hull, so that's a little bit easier. But there's a big, don't build a replica ship unless you can afford to run it, and build a replica ship that has an income stream for it that's big enough to generate income. Dyfken always had the problem that she couldn't generate enough income, and it was a very fine line in terms of fundraising. You have to be totally committed to the fundraising, totally committed to the education program, for the ship to work, because it can't, you know, it's a ship, you know, you can't fill it up with thousands of passengers.
Well, if we had plane loads and cruise ship loads of people turning up as they do in Stockholm, you've got a ready constant supply of people to go and look at that vessel. And that's probably one of the problems here, I suppose.
I think the great tragedy, if there's a tragedy in Dyfken, and I should say that the ship is her future is secure in Sydney. Your federal taxes are being paid,
well spent.
Well spent looking after the ship. She's being looked after properly. It's great. But if the state government in Western Australia had shown more vision, they would realise that they could have kept that ship in Western Australia by paying some money, and. I think as I just look at, say that, you know, did the state government spend $10 or $12 million on the Coldplay concert? Could have built 3 Dyfkens for that money.
Graham, we're getting close to the end of this really interesting discussion. It could go in so many directions. Towards the end of your book, you have a small section acknowledging a whole range of people who made this happen all the way through, and you ought to be acknowledged in there, and in many ways you are, because your name's on the front of the book and the end of the book. What did inspire you to write this book? How did you go about it, and who do you hope will read it?
Wow. I was inspired to read it when to write it when the Dyfken Foundation was being closed down in Fremantle. And I'd always thought that it was that we should record the story because the foundation was going down. Then Michael Young passed away after an illness, a long illness. And I thought that was sad. And I realised that all of the people around from when I was with the ship back in 1994, the first months of 94, that we were all going. And I'd been involved with the ship for 20 years. And I knew the stories exactly. And bless them, the volunteers, you'd be on the ship sometimes and the volunteers would be telling the story and you'd think, that's not really the story. This is what really happened. And so I thought, well, I should write the story while I still remember the story. And during COVID, my consultancy work dried up a little bit. I was only working 2 days a week, and I'm not the sort of person that's going to sit down for 3 days and do nothing. So I started doing it, the title of the book is Through Darkest Seas, because they weren't all good times. There were some tough times, and there were some real times when we had to ask ourselves, what in the hell are we doing here? Are we glorifying the Dutch East India Company by building this ship, one of the original rapacious multinational, I guess. Maybe the royal families were the original rapacious multinationals.
You only need to see the beautiful houses built on the canals in Amsterdam.
That's right. So we asked that question a lot, and we also thought a lot about the Aboriginal people, of the influence that the beginning of these sort of colonial activities happened. But I thought, we need to record all of this stuff. We need to talk about that we did this and we made our attempts at coming to grips with it. And so the ship's gone from Fremantle. She's in a good home, but she's Fremantle's ship. When Richard Utting made a speech on Market Street when the ship was coming through, he said, Fremantle was the centre of the universe, as Richard would always go on bang on about. Fremantle was the same, and we handed him a big bell jar of shavings from the ship, which are the umbilical cord symbolically of the ship in Indonesian culture. The shipwrights, the shavings are the remains of the birth of the ship, and said that the ship will always be home ported in Fremantle. And yeah, that's perfectly true. The ship is in Sydney now, but her heart is in Fremantle, I think. And I just wanted to make sure everybody remembered that. And if they go and have a look at the ship, they know the incredible things we did with the ship.
And as I say, ideally, who would you like to pick this up and trawl through it?
Oh, wow. Well, one of the ship's captains said to me, it's a manual. This book is a manual for everybody thinking that it'd be a good idea to build a replica ship. They should read it and then decide not to. But I just think anybody with an interest in the sea and what happens in Fremantle and the great brush of history and what it really takes to build a ship. Sailing a ship is one thing, but there are hundreds of people behind the scenes building sailing ships. And the captain and the crew sailor away, and it's history repeats.
Graham Cox, it's been absolutely delightful talking to you about the Doyfken, and a lot of people will be fascinated to go back into a relatively recent period of Fremantle history, and I'm sure a number of them will want to buy the book and read it. So congratulations.
Thank you.